This is The Source on Texas Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. For a parent, when you come home from work and you see your teen playing video games again all day long, it can be irksome. So why aren't you doing something constructive? That might be the gripe to the offspring gamer. Well, maybe they are doing something constructive. Maybe that game is shaping that teen's brain to tackle more information faster and develop neural pathways that will pay off bigly down the line. Or maybe that game, with all of its information overflow, is super soothing to that child and is actually therapeutic. Science is looking at what is happening to the brain on video games, and there's growing evidence that it's generally a good thing, and it could be digital medicine. We're talking about digital medicine this hour. Do you think playing video games has helped you or your kids in life? What questions do you have about hacking the brain with video games? Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org and tweet us at tprsource. We're joined by Dr. Adam Ghazali. He's the founder and executive director of the Neuroscape Lab at the University of California, San Francisco. He is speaking this evening at the Mind Science Foundation at the Pearl Stables, talking about digital medicine. And also with us is Debbie Fitzenmeier. She is the founding executive director at the San Antonio Youth Code Jam, where they have hackathons and they're teaching kids in San Antonio about coding and developing games and all sorts of good things and websites. And also with us is Dr. Charles Bowden. He is a psychiatrist at the UT Health San Antonio, and he helped develop an app which takes a look at bipolar mood disorders and helps people monitor their condition and find better and suitable therapies. Welcome to The Source, all of y'all. It's great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So, yes. Dr. Ghazali, tell me about video games. How good are they?
That's a tough question, because video games like food or sports is a very large genre. And so I always first try to reframe that question by saying that just like everything in life, yin and yang, things could have positive or negative effects. So I think the thing that we can agree upon is that video games are a very powerful form of interactive media that can influence behavior, and that could go in either way. So that's, the promise of video games is that you can take what they do so well, which is immerse and engage people and challenge their brains, and use that to create powerful experiences to improve their cognition and improve their behavior. That is my interest in video games.
What does the brain look like on video games?
I mean, again, there's a lot of different types of video games. Some could be very slow-moving, long playing strategy games. The games that we create and we build all of our games customized to challenge the brain are usually very, very interactive. And so you see lots of engagement throughout the brain, especially the prefrontal cortex, the most evolved part of our brain, which is involved in controlling your behavior in very complex environments.
So one of the most popular video games is Call of Duty Online. A lot of people play that, or Counter-Strike, things where it's first-person shooter action. The player is highly immersed into this, looking at this two-dimensional screen, trying to interpret a 3D space in there, looking for opponents and shooting them before they shoot them, each other. What happens with that?
So that's an interesting type of game, first-person shooters. In many ways, they're the most controversial of all video games because they have the most violent content and the most real-world violent content. But studies have shown, and I haven't done any of that work myself, but I was actually inspired by those studies to do the customized video games that don't have violence that we create. But if you look at studies of young people that play first-person shooters and you compare their cognitive performance, especially a particular type of cognition known as cognitive control, so their attention, their ability to multitask, their ability to resist distraction, and you compare it to young people that don't play first-person shooters, they're much better on those neuropsychological tests. If you take young people that don't play and have them play even for 10 hours and compare all sorts of these different measures, including just visual processing in general, you see that they exceed another group that played a different game, a game like Tetris. So that type of not just immersive environment, but environment that really challenges cognitive control because there are so many different tasks, as you described, going on. They have to focus their attention on details. They have to keep their attention broad so they don't shoot one of their friends. There's a high amount of reward that drives that engagement. Those games have shown to improve young people's cognitive control abilities.
So you mentioned multitasking. That's a controversial topic because some people say there is no such thing as multitasking. Actually, what people are doing is hyper-switching tasks.
So that's true. So I also study multitasking a lot independent of video games. And multitasking is a behavior, something that we try to do. So in that sense, it exists, right? I'm going to do these next three tasks over the next hour. But if you look at what happens in the brain mechanistically, if the tasks demand attention, then they're not parallel processed simultaneously. There is rapid switching. And with each switch, there's a degradation of performance. But what we have found, we built a game that actually challenges you to multitask, despite the fact that we don't do it very effectively and we switch between tasks. And what we found was that when we had a group of older adults play our multitasking video game called NeuroRacer, we didn't just improve their ability to multitask on the game because they're switching more rapidly, but we actually improved other skills that were not directly trained, their attention ability and their working memory. So that's what we're really trying for in the research side, is to not just improve performance on the game, but because different aspects of cognition are attached or connected, we can show other things get better through gameplay.
All right, let's take a call real quick. The number is 210-614-8980 if you want to join our conversation as we talk about digital medicine and video games. Brandon has called in, and Brandon, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, my name's Brandon. I've been playing video games my entire life, and there's two things I want to bring up. The first thing is that, what's the real difference when you're looking at the term game? Just the term game in general. When you look at a basketball game like NBA 2K and a game of basketball, what's the real difference? I mean, besides the actual physical activity, we're still engaging the brain. And the second thing I want to bring up is in dealing with using games as a cognitive, as the ability to improve cognitive function. There was a video on the internet of a young woman who had severe eye issues, and through an optometrist prescription of Game Boy, Tetris, and Pokemon, she was able to improve her overall quality of life. And I would just like to throw that out there, because as someone who loves video games, I want to see it treated with more respect.
Okay, Brandon.
A lot of people don't respect it.
All right, so that is a long-time criticism, is that video games would hurt people's eyesights. Our eyesight, we've heard that, and is science bearing that out?
There's a lot of research, including the work on first-person shooters, that it improves visual processing. And then there are games that are now specifically designed for, like, amblyopia and other visual, you know, disorders or eye disorders. So, you know, this whole field has shifted dramatically, and it's bigger than just the digital medicine. Just I want to note that games for impact, some people call it, that games could be used for all types of improvement in behaviors and social functioning, even outside of the clinical type of changes that we're talking about.
Right,
now.
So there's so much about looking and seeing. Eyesight is not necessarily connected to the eye. It's the brain interpreting what comes through the eye, and through video games, we can actually train the brain to be a better, pay more attention to detail or grayscale and things like that.
That's what was done on the show.
All right, so we're going to take a quick break. We're going to talk to our other guests and take some of these other phone calls. When we come back, we're talking about digital medicine, how interactive technologies can treat brain disorders. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Maybe you're multitasking right now. You're driving down the road as you're listening to the radio. Maybe you're doing other things around the house while you're listening. Multitasking is something that is you can actually do. You're only capable of doing one thing at a time, but your brain is switching back and forth really rapidly, and you don't really notice. Playing video games is just like that as well. You really can improve your ability to multitask. We've discussed that in a previous segment here on The Source. We're talking about digital medicine and how interactive technologies can help treat brain disorders and actually sharpen documentary, Hack the Brain. With me to talk about that, we were talking with Dr. Adam Ghazali. He's the founder and executive director of Neuroscape Labs, University of California, San Francisco. And we have Dr. Charles Baldwin with us. He's a psychiatrist at UT Health San Antonio. We're going to talk about his app to help with bipolar disorder. And Debbie Fitzenmeier, she's with us. She's the founding executive director at San Antonio Youth Code Jam. And Debbie, you do so many things. How did you find time to start up the San Antonio Youth Code Jam?
Actually, I started it because my son wanted to learn how to code, and I couldn't find a resource for him. So I just made it and hit a nerve, I guess.
So what is that?
What is Youth Code Jam, the event? So we started out as an event. It's a large-scale event now. We have about 600 people come, kids and families. We have about 12 different coding stations, various languages, from drag-and-drop visual programming to robotics to Arduinos to Python and C programming, and the kids can sort of plug and play and move around and really get excited about coding.
Right. So when we talk about the theme about digital medicine, talk about how the relationship that a lot of these kids have that you deal with and video games. How do they see video games?
Well, the kids obviously love it. Our mission is really to move kids from consuming to creating, because I think that's when, I don't want to say that's when the brain kicks in, because clearly we know now that's not the case. There's lots of good stuff that goes on when you're playing the game, but at the same time, when you start learning to actually create the games, either through a visual programming like Scratch or through a language, you're teaching computational thinking skills, logic, systems processing, all kinds of brain work that falls over into school and into career later on in life.
You know, I've said often that learning to write is learning how to think. And so writing stories and essays, but I think the same thing applies to writing code. And it's where we call it writing code. Is a grammar involved, a syntax, and the clearer you are, the better your code.
Yeah, we actually sometimes do an activity. Sometimes it's done with peanut butter sandwiches, but you can do it with almost anything. And try and get somebody to actually follow your directions, and you'll start to see how our brain makes a lot of assumptions in giving people directions. Put the peanut butter on the bread. Well, in computer language, you'd pick up the jar and put it on top of the bread as opposed to sticking the knife in. So it really does make you start to break things down into its smallest steps.
And how was that helpful to the youth that show up at your events?
Well, again, I'm not a scientist. We're not doing research. I'm just, we have a lot of anecdotal evidence from parents. And if you talk to moms, I think moms oftentimes are the first scientist in a child's life, the first researcher, and the ability to really break down what we're seeing. And what we find is that when these kids start to get engaged with the games, their thinking seems to, they are able to focus. They're able to break things down into very simple steps, and that overflows into their schoolwork and the other activities that they're participating in. And then we found specifically with students with autism that their parents are reporting back to us that there's a real significant impact. I had one mom tell me that after our September event, her son came home and had the longest conversation she'd ever had with him. That's not significant if you're the parent of a neurotypical kid, but when you're the parent of a neurodiverse kid, that's huge to be able to actually have a conversation with your child.
Say autism, we're talking about generally children who are higher up on the spectrum and who maybe just have a high level of social anxiety and that type of lack of eye contact and language issues?
Yeah, most of the kids that we work with are higher up on the spectrum. They've got verbal skills. Many of them are profoundly gifted. And the way that their brains work is very well suited in many times to computer science and to programming. In fact, we find companies like Microsoft and SAP actually going out publicly and saying, if you have autism, we want to hire you. So now we've opened up a career track for these kids. And when they come together and they're with other people who are engaged around their same big ideas, they can have conversations and they can start to build some social understanding and social skills around the concept of gaming as well. So it sort of has this dual effort.
Let's go to the phone lines. The number is 210-614-8980. A lot of people want to join our conversation as we talk about digital medicine here on The Source. Gabriel is on the line. And Gabriel, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. I just have two questions, and I'll take my answers off the air when I'm done. The first question is, I know there are a lot of groups that have tried to tie behaviors by children, violent behaviors by children, to video games, and I still have yet to see any verifiable proof that that has any relation to gaming any more than it does to violent movies or reading a violent act in a book of fiction. But I do see a lot of what you might refer to as cyberbullying. I see a lot of kids and even young adults go into taking advantage of the gaming itself, the coding itself, by using things like exploits, feeding into that reward system, and also trying to just simply cheat the system by using these exploits or using hacks, is what they might call it, or even using them as a means to grief an opponent or even cyberbully. And I'm wondering if there's been any kind of research into that. And then my second question is, with video games exponentially increasing in complexity, I personally think that they teach sort of complex social skills when you're especially dealing in MMOs, but also with situational awareness and what they also mentioned was hand-eye coordination. These video games can actually be broken down into different types. You mentioned first-person shooters. Call of Duty was one. That's what you might call a sort of a walking down a hallway type of game versus a sandbox game, which is more open. In other words, there's a lot of different types of games with a lot of different aspects, and I'm wondering, when these research studies are conducted, do they pay any particular focus on that, or is it just kind of a wash of different games that they're all treated as more or less the same, even though when you're playing them, the individuals playing them might react to these situations differently because of the way different games, I guess, involve you.
Okay, Gabriel, we got a lot there, so we're going to try and attack some of these issues that you brought up. Let's go to the first thing you brought up, was violent video games. And Dr. Ghazali, I'm sure this is something that comes up every time you talk about video games.
Yeah, you know, the data is very mixed on that. And I don't personally study violent video games. All the video games that we make don't have violence in them. I think if you're starting a game from scratch to serve as a tool to help people's brain function, if you don't need violence, you know, it certainly seems simpler not to have it. But if you look at the literature, you know, there's data on both sides. And it's super complicated to do this, as you said, because violence is present in so many forms of media that it's really hard to control it. I would say if there's anything there, it seems like maybe there's a little bit increase in aggressiveness of people, and that might even be acute, just like right after gameplay.
Well, let me think. Well, Doom came out in, what, 1996, 97? We got a generation of people who've been playing these games. We're dealing with a society now that has less violence than ever before. So if there is a connection between violence and video games, it's not showing up in the FBI statistics.
Yeah, it's not. It's certainly not overwhelming. And there are people that study this that, you know, and I've been on these panels where I've seen people argue both sides of it. If it's there, it seems to be more subtle, and it depends on how you do your metrics. The cyberbullying in games is very real and very complex. I am not aware of a ton of research on it, but because we build video games, I interact with a lot of commercial video game companies, and like League of Legends, for example, made by Riot, they have an entire system now constructed to help manage online behavior, which is global, right? I mean, there's kids in all different countries playing together all the time, and how do you create a new society in a way, certainly a new community at the very least, that has rules of conduct and engagement that are appropriate? It's a fascinating topic in itself.
Yeah, you'll be playing, if you go online and play a game, you'll be playing against Russians and Germans and Australians, depending on what time of night you're on, and you will develop a new appreciation for international competition. But when you hear terrible things, people shout at each other, and the insults that they come up with, it's not It's not patty cake when the verbal exchange.
Well, you know, there is the sense of anonymity, which contributes to that. When you have to say something to someone's face directly, it's very different than when you could do it through some, you know, avatar name that's not you. And then they are very intense situations, and they're young people that are playing them. And so you have all the ingredients for a behavior that's not acceptable. But, you know, and it's not just true of video games, right? You go on social media, you see the same type of bullying and
right.
blogs everywhere. So, but I know that the game world is aware of
it. You also run into some really cool people as well.
Totally. I mean, it's always pluses and minuses. And it's just a challenge to build a community of people that never see each other face to face, but people are interested in making it a better, healthier community. And I think that's very cool.
And the caller brought up MMOs, which is massive multiplayer online universes. I guess like World of Warcraft is one of them that people may be familiar with. And that's interesting because you are interacting with other people online and you are developing social skills. And they say that's the way that the 21st century workplace is going to be generally online. And so those skills you develop playing MMOs could be valuable as we stop commuting to work and we just log in.
You know, just to go back to the very first point, video games is a massive genre. You brought up sandbox games like Minecraft, where they're much more creative, the goals are less well-defined. We've talked about first-person shooters, you know, massive online strategy games. We think of all of these, to borrow, you know, just to return to the topic of digital medicine, to borrow a term from the pharmaceutical industry, we think that these are all potentially active ingredients. And so we take all the different types of games and all the different types of interactivities you can have with interactive media very seriously and think about how they all might have different benefits in different group of people when applied. So there's a lot there, and we do try to dissect it out and understand how each of those types of interactive experiences could have different benefits.
So are we at a point yet where doctors are prescribing to play certain games for any type of purpose or use?
I would say no. I've never heard of that. We now have a study that's a phase 3 FDA trial of an offshoot of a game I created, NeuroRacer, that is now in a trial to get FDA approval to become a therapeutic device to treat children with ADHD. And we'll know that the result of that. It's 9 sites already across the U.S. We'll know that data by the end of this year. If so, we will have an indication, if everything goes well, to have a prescribable video game and hopefully reimbursable, where a doctor would pull out their prescription pad and just as quickly as they might write a drug for ADHD, which is the only prescribable treatment right now, they'd write a video game.
So you're looking at neuroplasticity of the brain, which is rewiring of the brain. So I'm really interested in seeing of a benefit fall off on individuals who play NeuroRacer and how long they will see benefits of the game.
We're studying that now. So the only data we have to that is in our Nature paper in 2013 on older adults that showed that we had preserved benefits 6 months later without even re-engaging in the game. On all of our studies now using Evo, which is what NeuroRacer became.
So that tells you right there that it's not behavioral modification, but it is changing actual neural pathways.
And we even have neural data showing those neural pathways changing. So we build our game so that you could record neural activity during gameplay as well, so you can understand the mechanisms of change. So I'd say that there's both going on. It's also possible that a game could have sustained effects because it actually does change your behavior. So now we have a 70-year-old in our study. They played NeuroRacer for a month, and now they're more empowered to engage in technology, or even to engage in the world in a more rich way, and that actually helps maintain them, not just what they learn from the gameplay itself.
And now they become addicted to playing video games. So we'll talk about that, video game addiction. When we come back from the game, I want to bring in our third guest. I'm sorry I've neglected you, Dr. Bowden. I want to talk to you about your the app that you have looking at bipolar disorder and monitoring people who have been diagnosed with this and how this app is benefiting them and your research into this area as well. Our phone lines are open. The number to call in if you got a question about digital medicine and playing video games, what's it doing to your brain, a good and bad. The number to call in is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. We'll be right back after this. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about video games, not just dropping quarters in a big box anymore and playing a round of Pac-Man. Video games are part of our lives. They've gotten more intense, more more interactive, and they're changing the way that people's brains work for the good and for the bad. We're talking about that this afternoon with Dr. Adam Ghazali, founder and executive director of the Neuroscape Lab at the University of California, San Francisco. He's speaking this evening at the Mind Science Foundation event at the Pearl Stable. Also with us is Debbie Fitzenmeier. She is the founding executive director at the San Antonio Youth Code Jam, and they hold hackathons, and they're teaching youth in San Antonio and beyond how to master computer coding. And there's all sorts of benefits to that and developing a career and also learning how to master themselves as well. But let's talk to our third guest, Dr. Charles Bowden. He is a psychiatrist at UT Health San Antonio. And you have, with partners, I believe, developed an app that takes, that measures individuals how they present themselves with bipolar disorder. Is that right?
We're not quite to the point of commercial use of the app, but give us another 3 months and we'll be there.
So a lot of people know Fitbits. You know, you put it on there and it tells you that you didn't go to the gym today. But there, something like this could be very beneficial when we're trying to figure out sleep patterns or activities. And is that what you were looking at?
Well, you're right to use Fitbit as an example. But Fitbit is generally only giving you one dimension. How many bases? But we have eight items, and the eight items cover common, recognizable by patients, by family members, friends of people with bipolar disorder. And there's a lot more out there than just the number of.
So what are a couple of the top eight items that you're looking at?
Feeling of not needing sleep at night. A person who stays up till 3 a.m., night after night, usually is asking for trouble, not all of the time, but some of the time. That's a clear indication of bipolar in the brain. Energy, slowed down energy on the depressed side, but excessive energy on
like lethargy?
The manic side. By lethargy, yeah. But all of these are...
So are you asking the individual to sort of check in at certain times and establish benchmarks where they are right now?
Except he or she is pre-checked in. They agree to use this at present in these studies. Easiest studies to recruit I've ever participated in 40 years of work, because these people are looking for something like this. The only thing they don't like about the study is that it's had an ending, and they want correctly to be able to continue to use something that they find beneficial.
So bipolar disorder, that's not depression. This is something different, right? This is a mood disorder.
It's a mood disorder with shifting. It's sort of like the weather in Texas. The jokes of, if you don't like the weather, wait around 10 minutes and it will change. That can be sort of the bipolar individual. He or she often knows that, but doesn't have the skills or the experience to turn that into making advantage of some of the energy, let's say. So this puts the patient more in charge of what he or she with some degree of bipolar disorder, which is the case in 4 or 5% of the people, not just in the U.S., but every country.
So bipolar disorder, we people who have manic, very highs and then very lows, and I think we all kind of feel that way to some extent. We have good days and bad days, and everyone would love to be able to have some sort of control over how you feel from day to day to try and be on the days that you've got, you know, big demands on you. Is there any way that people could, just typical individuals, could benefit from this type of technology in managing their moods? And, you know, we all want to be at our meet our maximum potential, especially when the chips are on the line.
We're not focused on every man in the street at this point. In part because it's all we can manage with the staff and the NIH grant funding that we have for this, to have conducted one study that we just submitted for publication in a mood disorder psychiatric journal. And we're finishing up a large study, three departments of psychiatry at medical schools in San Antonio, Cincinnati, and Kentucky. So those studies have been the easiest to recruit to that I've ever experienced. And it's in part because the person already recognizes that he sometimes is dispirited when he shouldn't be dispirited, unable to concentrate when he should be able to concentrate, but sometimes able to concentrate and take benefit from some of the characteristics of that go along with high energy.
So as a psychiatrist, what are your concerns about people who play video games? Do you have any?
I think you would probably find, and this is strictly speculation, so it's not worth a lot, but that impulsivity, the look before you leap, is likely to be dysfunctional in the person with bipolar disorder.
Mm-hmm. And you think, would they benefit from, you know, playing games as a way to deal with, as digital medicine, to alter their states? You know, you could start, you can log on in one state being sort of low energy and not really into it, and you can log off with, you know, neurotransmitters firing like crazy and ready to take on the day.
The idea is a good one, and you probably could take some of the elements that we've worked into this, but we've used empirical data on the symptoms that make up the official criteria for diagnosis of bipolar disorder, just the way a doctor would use criteria for diagnosis of, let's say, diabetes. So that doesn't mean, just as we're talking about the Fitbit analogy, that some of the things that we're looking at in people with bipolar disorders could help those of us around the table here.
So what do you think of digital medicine versus the pharmaceutical medicine? What would you know, if we could figure out ways to alter people's states to help boost their mood, give them more buoyancy throughout the day without having to pump them up with pharmaceuticals?
Pharmaceuticals have a place, but oftentimes...
But they have side effects.
Absolutely. And oftentimes the recommendations that flow from kiosks are recommendations of the way to handle the day. When do I get up today? How much sleep do I get, and when do I try to start that sleep this evening? Those kinds of things, simple things. So this isn't rocket science in terms of application. If it were so hard that you couldn't get to the end of the recommendation, you wouldn't have people with the enthusiasm that we see in these patients that we work with.
All right, Dr. Bowden. Let me go to another caller. Michelle has called in, and our phone line is 210-614-8980. Michelle, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. I had a question for Debbie. I'm fascinated with how she's positioned this as far as workforce development. And I'm wondering, we've talked a lot about coding, we talked a lot about video games, but clearly there's opportunities to write code and do other things and be able to see kids be successful and have healthy brains. And I wonder if she could talk more about that.
Debbie, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. I think it's why we really focus on moving from just the consumption of these video games and this mindless ongoing playing of, you know, games, and moving them into the actual skill that leads to workforce development, which would be the actual coding. And we find that when kids get super engaged with it, we already talked about the fact that we see their computational thinking improve, their logic improve, their problem solving improve, and at some levels their persistence improve as well. And we know that these types of skill sets translate very clearly into the workforce. And we find that particularly with students on the autism spectrum, they may not, the high-functioning ones, their parents may or may not know if their child will ever find a place to work with some of the social challenges and social anxiety that they have. And these are workplaces that really seek these individuals out and find their particular skill set, their particular neurodiversity of importance and valued in those environments. And so I think that when we can move from consuming to creating, we end up with a potential job, which every parent wants for their child.
And real quickly, we've heard a lot about this distracted generation because there's so many things, but do you see that or do you see hyper-focus when it comes to these tasks?
Yeah, I think it depends on the child. It's really interesting. So at our big event in September, I find kids bouncing from station to station to station without a lot of focus. But you come to our low sensory event when we're focusing on just kids with sensory processing disorder and high functioning autism and ADHD, and they actually spend quite a bit of time at each station. They'll find what they want to do, sit down, and they become hyper focused.
And that's where it comes on. That's the payoff.
That for everybody, for the kids and for the parents.
All right, so we're going to continue our conversation, join the conversation as we talk about digital medicine, brain plasticity, a game addiction. We're going to get to that question, so much more on The Source. The number is 210-614-8980. This is The Source. We'll be right back. You're listening to Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. This is The Source. I'm David Martin Davies. Can playing video games actually make you smarter, sharpen your noodle? There's cutting-edge research that is looking at the brain as player one enters the game. I know that one of our researchers, our guest, Dr. Adam Cazale, you have a thing called the glass brain. Is that right? You're able to look at the brain as someone's playing a game? Tell them about that.
Yeah, so as we evolve this field of using an interactive experience to help improve brain function, we want to bring it to the next level. And there's so many other technologies that are available in neuroscience and in the consumer entertainment space that we're interested in. So from virtual reality to augmented reality, motion capture, wearable physiological devices, and also artificial intelligence and machine learning algorithms. The glass brain is our attempt to record brain activity in real time while people are involved in the game and have the game not just respond to their performance, which is what all of our games do now. So if you're faster, if you're more accurate, the game gives you a little bit more of a challenge. Well, where we're going is to record brain activity non-invasively through a cap that you could even wear at home. The game doesn't just understand how fast or accurate you are. It actually sees what's going on inside your brain, and it could challenge you or give you feedback and reward based on the processing of the information in your brain. So we think that's going to be like a very targeted type of neurofeedback approach that uses video games to create the interactivity, but then the glass brain and the recordings to make it more focused.
There's been a lot of research into neurofeedback and trying to do things like lower blood pressure. And is that something that could be applied in that area?
I mean, the applications are massive and incredibly broad. We tend to focus on attention and memory and perception in our group, but many others are focused on different aspects of physicality, stress, mood management, motor skills. It's as broad as you can imagine. Any aspect of human behavior could potentially be targeted by a type of interactive experience.
Back to the phones, 210-614-8980 with Chris. And Chris, hi, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I had a two-part question for the researchers. In terms of the person gaming, is there any studies conducted that looks at the macro class of the individuals that typically game? And then on the micro level...
You mean from a demographic point of view, like who plays games?
From a demographic point of view, like who are these who's the typical gamer? And in terms of their involvement in the actual community, on the micro individual level, what is their level of involvement in sort of civic, real activities? Is my question. And then the context, I guess, would be: I grew up, around games, and I noticed that the sort of people that had more resources and things to do gamed less. And the people that were kind of right there in the middle, had cash, disposable cash, the middle class, they enjoyed gaming, but typically would do less and, invest less in sort of vacations and activities and stuff like that. So,
okay. Chris, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. So, Adam, do you have any idea who is the typical gamer? And the gamer is a large umbrella, because that could be anyone from people playing Candy Crush to crossword puzzles online to Call of Duty.
Right. Well, the typical gamer is still the young male boy. That is, I would say that's the typical. But games have changed dramatically, and you alluded to some games like Candy Crush, Farmville, that the demographics are dramatically different than they were even a decade ago. So we now know that it's pretty much 50-50 males and females, if you look right across the whole spectrum. And we know that the average gamer is pretty close to 40 years old now. So it's changed, especially as young gamers become older, but also because the industry has matured and learned that there are certain types of experiences and interactivity that are favored by both genders and favored by different age groups. So you have many seniors that play video games as well now. So that's changed quite dramatically and will continue to.
And Debbie?
I can address the issue of civic involvement because I think that's an important question. We have about 150 volunteers, and many of them are gamers. And I think for them, it's about finding a relevant and meaningful way to give back to community. And when they can utilize their skill set to be engaged, they give back civically in the community.
And there's organization Penny Arcade. They've been very active in raising funds for a lot of charities, and so they're very good. So to think that you're just in your basement playing games and not tuned into the world is really not an accurate description of your typical gamer. Let me talk about addiction. We had a question from the emailer asking about game addiction. Is that a problem that you've come across, Adam?
Well, there is addiction not just to drugs as an alcohol, but think about gambling. There's behavioral addictions that can be very powerful and very pathological as well to all sorts of behaviors, including online behaviors. Social media has an addiction, and video games is not without that challenge.
So anytime you're going to get dopamine squirting into the brain, you're going to find some addictive behavior.
Yeah, especially because video games are designed by very smart people that understand reward cycles and know how to really bring them on at a high level. That being said, if you look at the true addiction symptoms at its most sort of critical level, it's still a small number of people that reach that pure, true pathological level of addiction. That doesn't mean that many people that aren't quite there aren't having challenges in their life by overplaying video games. They just might not have hit that threshold. So I think it is a very real challenge for someone like myself and our center at UCSF that's building video games as therapeutic tools. We take it really seriously because, as we know, everything has side effects. Every great thing that you do, you can abuse and have negative impacts. And it would be irresponsible to think that this did not have it. And addiction, or let's just call it overuse, would be one that is a very real one. We wouldn't want to create a game to help children with ADHD and then have them not engage in social interactions or physical exercise or go to school. So what we actually do in our FDA trial, if you're going to conduct an FDA trial, in addition to looking for effect size and outcomes that are meaningful, you also have to monitor side effects, and you have to position what those are and how you control them. So when we positioned it, we said, well, maybe overuse is an issue. So what we get to do, unlike pharmaceuticals, is actually restrict the amount of use that a young person has with the game. So if you're in our study right now, our ADHD study, you can only play for half an hour a day. The game shuts down. You can't engage in it until the next day. So unlike drugs, we have the ability to control the dosage and also monitor compliance remotely.
Right, I'm going to get you, Debbie, in just a second. But I'm going to ask Dr. Baldwin about this, since you're a psychiatrist, about, avoidance anxiety is a very real thing. And people, they have some sort of unpleasant task coming up. They would like to do something different. And frequently people will just say, well, I cannot step away from this video game because I don't want to go to school, or I don't want to have to deal with real life. Is that something that you can address?
I think so. And address it also in terms of, are there some people who gamble where it's tied to some psychiatric disorder, bipolar or otherwise? If you look at the criteria, not just in the U.S., not just in 2017, but throughout all recent history, anxiety is known to be one of the most common symptoms that people have, and have it from a very early age, yet it's not a criteria for making a diagnosis of bipolar disorder. Peculiar finding. And Yet if you look at what's predictive of the course of bipolar disorder, anxiety is one of the very top things. So just because something is known doesn't necessarily mean that it gets applied in the way that would really be to the benefit of an individual or society.
You know, and just because you're playing a video game doesn't mean you're in an anxiety-free environment, but maybe you're able to kind of control it, or you're able to distance yourself or have some sort of disengagement from that anxiety, and maybe that could be something that could be used to deal with people who have anxiety disorders. But Debbie, you wanted to add something.
I think the addiction piece is really important, because I can tell you several years back I was at South by Southwest when Angry Birds had just come out, and I met with the founders, and they specifically said they went out to design a game. What if you could design a game that was addictive? That was their goal. So a practical tip for parents, I think, is it's important for them to know what their kids are doing online, what are they playing, how they are engaging. If a child is engaging in a video game and is showing empathy, you might not want to back out of that game for a while, but certainly the limitation piece, and then certainly migrating them into the creation piece, I think helps with that issue.
And so, Dr. Adam Ghazali, talk about where you're going with this research. How will this help people? When will digital medicine become part of our normal life?
So we hope that by the end of this year, 2017, we'll have the first FDA-approved video game ever, and the first non-drug treatment for ADHD that's prescribable and FDA approved. That we think will open up a whole new category of medicine that we talk about and consider digital medicine to run in parallel to molecular medicine. We think that what we will show over the coming years, and this is just a hypothesis, is that sometimes we might want to have a pharmaceutical, but we can give it with a much lower dose, use it as an activator as opposed to a solo treatment, and then use the game and the interactivity and the targeted type of challenges that a game offers to get more effects out of that very drug. So the thing that I hope we see more of is a decrease in the silos that we've created around every single treatment, that it is a holy grail. That's unlikely going to work for something as complex as the human brain. So as we march through the years, we'll hopefully see not just video games, but other types of technology that sit so largely in entertainment, media, communication, switch into the world of health, medicine, and also education, educational tools for even healthy, young, developing minds.
All right, Dr. Adam Ghazali, he's the founder, executive director of Neuroscape Lab at the University of California, San Francisco. He is speaking this evening at the Mind Science Foundation's event at the Pearl Stables. Also with us is Debbie Fitzenmeier, founding executive director of the San Antonio Youth Code Jam. They do the hackathons. Where do people find you online?
YouthCodeJam.org.
And you'll have events how often?
We do. We have events. We have one in May, one in September, and all summer long.
And what are the ages?
7 to 17.
All right. And Dr. Charles Bowden, he is a psychiatrist at UT Health Science here in San Antonio, UT Health San Antonio. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.